Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and we're going to be doing something a bit different today on the 53rd, I beg your pardon, a little trouble there, on the 53rd anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision. We thought we'd take the first hour to commemorate that decision and the aftermath of that decision, maybe even celebrate its overturning nearly 4 years ago. But mostly we thought, let's try to have a nice, calm conversation in which we invite our pro-choice listeners to hear again the pro-life position. Because one thing that we have learned over the years here at Catholic Answers is people are willing to listen. People are good at heart. Most people are anyway. I won't name the ones that I think aren't, but most people are good at heart and willing to listen. And so we have the opportunity not to just rehash all the old arguments, not to just respond in anger or in the kind of competition of ideas, but to say, let's see if we can phrase the pro-life argument in a way that will maybe move the needle with you a little bit, if you'll let us do that. And that's entirely up to you if you would like to listen to that. But I think the essential question we want to ask today as pro-life people who are asking, hey, could you listen to this one more time and see if we can move the needle a little bit with you? Because the law has changed, but we certainly do not have agreement with one another in the United States or around the world about how abortion should be treated or how abortion should be thought about. So I'm going to give a conditional question. If the unborn child is a human being, because I do think that one of the ways the needle has moved over the course of the years is more and more people have been willing to at least acknowledge this, that the child conceived in the womb, once the fertilization of the egg happens, to use the scientific way of speaking about it, once the fertilization happens, you have a new creature. And the nature of that creature is human. So I think most people are willing to go, yeah, I accept the basic science on that. But then different arguments come in about what that means and what the moral calculus is. So I'm going to assume goodwill on the part of most people willing to listen to basic science, which says, of course, that my life, your life, all of our life started at a particular moment. And then what happens after that is development. So what we have is a wildly undeveloped human creature. It's a one-celled creature. So if that's the case, I'll start with that conditional. How should a compassionate society respond when both the mother and the child are vulnerable? What should be our response to that fact, to that I think most of us have come to agree on? Although I'm not going to assume that everybody has, so we still have work to do as far as advancing that argument. But I'm just talking in biological terms, because someone might say, well, there's no soul there. I'm just talking in biological terms. We know how the organism, a mammal organism begins. And so I would like to talk, and then I will bring in our guest for this hour, Tom Nash. I would like to just present the pro-life, a history of the pro-life movement that maybe pro-choice people have not heard before. And if you haven't heard this, will it affect the way you think about the whole pro-life thing, the whole pro-life attitude? Maybe. And I wonder if you have heard this story before, because when I talk about the embryonic human creature, actually, we're coming up on the 200th anniversary of science understanding what an embryonic human that the embryonic human creature even exists. There was a I think somewhat famous scientist, Karl Ernst von Baer, in Prussia, who in the 1820s did a series of experiments on mammals. And he's Carl Ernst von Baer is now thought of as the father of the modern science of embryology. He really invented the science of embryology in many ways. So the first organized pro-life movement in the United States is not in 1970. It's not in 1920. It's not in 1900. It starts in the 1850s because in the 1820s, particularly by 1827, Carl Ernst von Baer had convinced the scientific world of the existence of the human embryo. And this actually had a huge resonance. And it took a couple decades, but doctors began to realize that what they were doing when they aborted early stage pregnancies is not just aborting a pregnancy, but that there wasn't actually a human creature there. Because before that, there was a widespread kind of almost folk understanding of human life, which said, at quickening, we know we have a human person. But before quickening, we don't. There's no science to that. It's just a matter of that's when the woman can feel the baby move. Then, so that was taken as, okay, well, we can all agree there's a life there. So there was a sense before Carl Ernst von Baer that among a lot of doctors that, look, we're not taking a human life. We're taking a potential human life. After Carl Ernst von Baer, it began to dawn on doctors who were themselves performing abortions. Wait a second, I could be taking a human life here. And this changed everything. By the 1850s, the American Medical Association, which was trying, it certainly there's all kinds of mixed motives here. It was trying to turn, the American Medical Association was trying to turn prenatal care into a more scientific endeavor so that it had a more scientific basis. And so it was trying to raise the status of medical doctors, but particularly one medical doctor, Dr. Horatio Storer from Harvard University, launched a national campaign in the 1850s to oppose abortion. And Storer's argument, and Storer was not at this time a religious person. An interesting fact about Horatio Storer is by the end of his life, he became Catholic. And I don't know if that's related to his views on abortion. But he said, look, if the science is telling us that this is a human, we can't do this. It's unethical. And so there was this is what we might call the first pro-life movement. It was in the 1850s, 1860s, and 1870s, where there was a growing influence of scientists and doctors telling legislatures of states, you have to stop this. We have discovered something that we did not know before. The human being is present from the moment of conception. This is human life, and we even now know how it develops. So by the 1890s, every single state in the United States had some kind of ban on abortion. Whereas before, it was seen as, well, it's kind of a medical procedure that what I'm trying to say to the pro-choice person is, it was science that gave us the pro-life movement originally. It wasn't, now, was the Catholic Church always opposed to abortion? Yes, it was, all the way back to the first century. But not because the Catholic Church knew for certain when life began, but because the Catholic Church was extremely, because of the teaching of Jesus, was extremely careful about the life of each individual, and so wasn't willing to take any chances on this. And also, it had a contraceptive aspect to it, which the Church also opposed. So it's only after science, after the 1820s with Dr. Carl Ernst von Baer, and then after the 1850s with Dr. Horatio Storer, that legislatures in the United States began to think about the pro-life cause. Guess what? In 1973, with Roe versus Wade, those original pro-life laws are the ones that got overturned. These weren't this wasn't a revolution against the ancient oppression of the church or something. This was a revolution against the science of the 1900s, which had changed people's thinking. I wanted to start there with a little history of the pro-life movement so that you can see it's a movement rooted in science, not a movement rooted in faith. The church has followed the scientific teaching, but they didn't invent it. And We'll come back after the break, because I see I took quite a while there. We'll introduce our guest for this hour, Tom Nash, and we'll do just what we said we're going to do. We'll try to make the case again to the pro-choice person. Could you reconsider your pro-choice views and maybe be open to the pro-life movement, because it might not be a movement that's rooted in quite what you thought it was rooted in. And we'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Hello, friends. This is Deacon Charlie Echeverry from the Living the Call podcast, and I want to share with you a bit about why we need to go to confession. Reconciliation is our moment to speak to Christ honestly about our shortcomings. Confession is cathartic. It cleanses, it renews, and it strengthens all at the same time. If you haven't been to confession in a while, that's okay, but now might be that moment that God is calling you to come to Him and receive the grace of His mercy in the sacrament of reconciliation.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we're marking the 51st, excuse me, I keep saying 51st, I'm stuck in the past, the 53rd anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision. I know in June of 2022, that decision was overturned, but for pro-life people, we still mark this day because the consequences of the Roe versus Wade decision are everywhere. They're all around us. We've all lived with them. For decades, and we will live with them until we depart this earth. So if we can't have respectful conversations, we can't come to any resolution. So we thought in a respectful way, we would today ask pro-choice people, would you listen to the arguments anew? And we'll try to make them in a way that is respectful. Because even the way I pose the question, I hope is respectful, that we're talking about vulnerable women. In many cases, not always, certainly. So we don't want to make the pro-life argument where we only talk about the child. And because I think, well, we'll bring in Tom Nash. Tom Nash is a theologian and apologist here at Catholic Answers, author, has for a long time been a part of the pro-life movement. Tom, I do think we make a mistake as a pro-life movement when we speak of abortion as if it has, as if moms weren't there.
Yes, you have to. I mean, obviously, moms are there, and you have to start with that, and also start with the male responsibility in his part, because I think many. I have a saying that behind every radical feminist is a failed man and/or the fear of one. When you look up somebody. The founder of Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem. She had an abortion in the 50s out of wedlock. And so where's the committed male in her life? Kate Millett, who wrote Personal Politics, late 60s, very troubled home with her father being abusive. So I think a lot of times women turn to contraception and abortion as means to level the playing field regarding intimacy. And yet they end up precluding the very love that is a sacrificial, total self-giving love from the men that they interact with, such that oftentimes the man might change, but the type of man does not necessarily. And so you can have serial monogamy, and yeah, you're economically independent, but where are you? And then when you do have a child, of course, we see this frequently now, that with the increased unwed pregnancy, women always get the short end of the stick, and the kids who are raised in such homes are much more likely to have challenges and difficulties in life.
So it does seem to me that there is an important argument here to be made that's in what you just said about the fact that we have to acknowledge that pregnancy puts a woman in a tremendously vulnerable position.
Yeah.
And when society organizes itself in such a way that everybody's just an individual on their own.
Yes.
That actually is an argument for abortion because
autonomy.
Because it's not fair. It's not fair that we leave women alone to deal with pregnancy.
Yes.
That's not fair.
No, it's not. It's irresponsible. That's toxic masculinity, if we might point out.
Yeah.
And I remember a person, it was at a, got rather spirited argument at a, while I was a grad student at the University of Missouri, where I earned my master's in journalism. And the one young lady was talking about the much harder on the woman's body, that is the whole process of pregnancy versus an abortion. I go, yeah, but one takes a life and one gives it. But to your point and to her point, yes, that puts a woman in a very serious position, a precarious position. And it goes back to how are we teaching in our schools about love and respect? And do we do it by, as I would say, with more contraception abortion, which is putting gasoline on the fire? It's only going to exacerbate it. Or do we start teaching virtue, which could be discussed going back to the great ancient Greek philosophers, irrespective of particular religious beliefs? And I just think that educationally, young people, parents who are, I should say, parents of children who are in more vulnerable economic situations, giving them educational choices, not in terms of people say federal dollars for religious purposes, no, taxpayer rights. Letting parents choose, empowering the parents instead of imposing a system upon them. All those things can contribute to, I think, a more pro-life culture. But yeah, it goes back to the men that you have to look at her. Do we see ourselves in solidarity as a nation? And do we look to the government to mediate and resolve these issues? Or do we, look on the local level?
Well, but it does seem to me that the whole abortion thing it can't be divided from the coldness of our society, from the spiritual coldness of our society, that we, look, man, you're on your own. Get a job. We don't have a hearty community where people feel themselves integrated into any kind of functional community. And so there's no greater gift to men who want to be misbehaved than abortion. It solved a lot of men's problems.
And
it's, we got to be honest, a lot of girls who have been violated by men, like 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old girls, that problem has gone away for the man because of this free-willing abortion thing. So abortion solves a lot of problems for men, and it's sold as women's rights. But the thing is, this coldness that we have about marriage, that it's just, it's if my feelings aren't there, it's we'll move on to the next one. This lack of responsibility for one another, a lack of sense of responsibility.
Solidarity.
For one another, it seems to me that's, we have to have compassion on men who feel isolated and devastated by this destruction of community. And on women who they feel, I cannot imagine what it is to be 17, 18, 19, 20, 30 alone as a woman, and you're expected to go through this, which God made it so that women are, at a certain point in pregnancy, utterly vulnerable. Like, she probably won't survive if people don't help her. I mean, in many cases, at least, delivering the baby in those last weeks and the caring for the baby. And I mean, what kind of hunter gatherer does she make? What kind of, it's a condition of vulnerability that God gave us that men, we're able to be cads and just not be there for women.
And I think that aids and abets the radical feminism because
I don't want to be that vulnerable.
These are the rules, okay. And I sometimes say that self-induced sexism is like, okay, this is what it takes. But you saw it because it's like, yeah, a lot of men can be pigs, but if you jump into the sexual pig pen, you're putting it upon yourself, even if, again, you may be economically independent, the type of man you're going to be drawn to is not one who's typically going to be good for you. And this is, goes back to chastity and dealing with our passions and cultivating virtue, because otherwise, when it comes to passions, people, conscience goes out the window, and it's like, oh, we got a pregnancy, or oh, so-and-so, now I've been intimate with the person. Obviously, people know that it's sexual intimacy is something much more significant between a couple than just...
We know it in our bones.
Yeah,
you can harden your heart to it.
And women who are intimate outside, they feel like they got a claim on a guy, even if they're not married, because, hey, I've been intimate with
and
you.
And they do have a claim on him.
Yeah, and the problem is though... When the passions are not ordered, then we think about these consequences after the fact, and they impede us from bonding well long-term the more we are promiscuous. Now, people will say, oh, it's a matter of economics, and people who are more affluent are less likely to divorce than people who are less affluent. Yeah, but there's other factors, too, which are faith, solidarity, with the family. It's not simply a matter of economics. And I think this is where, if people are more vulnerable in their economics, give them opportunities, including educational choices, give them support mechanisms to help them be that family in various ways. This is where the government should be all about not replacing the family, but supporting the nuclear family. And if you don't do that, well, God help us. And we've redefined marriage and that.
But we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. No. We don't want to say to the gay couple, that's actually not that's not the same thing what you do. And we don't want to say to the contracepting couple, no, that's not a full human sexual engagement. We don't want to say to the divorced especially divorced who have children, it's actually not fair to the children. That we want to say everybody, we want to let everybody off the hook about how serious sex is, how morally fraught it is to turn sex into a casual
recreational
or even transient relationship, and take it out of the context of, look, the man here has to be so devoted that the woman can be vulnerable
precisely,
and the woman has to be so devoted that that the child's vulnerability is not violated, that the child can go through its stage of vulnerability.
This is where I think we talk about solidarity. Young women need the support of other women, married women, single women who are living chastity, so that they can be good fathers or good role models of a male, whether it's an uncle or some teacher, a priest, that will encourage them in that. They need to have the solidarity so that they can have the encouragement and the... If they have a heartbreak without being sexually intimate, it's like, this guy said, unless we're intimate, I'm not going to be progressing. We're not going to consider this further down the road as far as a relationship. It's like they need the support to be able to say no. And men, of course, need to be able to. I think if men act virtuously, this might sound sexist, the women will follow their good lead, because precisely your point earlier, they're recognizing them as individuals made in the image and likeness of God, and they are in a sense inviting them to a vulnerability precisely because they have their best interests at heart.
Right.
They're going to be totally committed.
Right. And men and women cannot be fulfilled if they can't be vulnerable with one another. But I have to say, in practice, women, in actual point of fact, the way if you talk to older couples and whatnot, it's often the woman who sets the rules, and the man has to, when she is clear that she's not going to put up with certain things from this guy. I've had my wife tell me when we were young about certain things. Look, she's just not going to put up with it,
It's good. It's good communication.
And it's good for you as a man to know, she needs this is not a game. There's things that I got to do. I got to step up. And often, I think women do play the role of getting men to step up. And so we discourage young women from doing that, because, you know, I don't know, what you don't want to be needy or demanding or that woman. You know, you have a right to say, look, here's the deal.
And yes, and, calling and, them and, to and, be a man.
Right. And I think it's good for us men when women do that. Like, do you know that, you know, you going out and say partying after work, that's not going to work anymore. We got kids now, you know,
yeah.
Or whatever the thing is, you know, whatever the thing is that you need to be called.
You can't go out with the boys as much.
I agree with you that men need to set this higher standard so that women have room to be able to be women, and part of being a woman, especially when it comes to motherhood, is being vulnerable.
And
like I think sometimes people hear that as like that's an insult to women. No, that's the way God made it. A woman has a really hard job bearing a child and giving birth to that child.
No doubt.
She will be medically vulnerable. She's like
my friend said in grad school.
That's the thing. So I'm not saying women are weaker than men or less than men. I'm saying that nature puts women in a position, that nature and nature's God, let's say,
yes,
of vulnerability. The whole thing of male monogamy and Jesus's teaching, you can't just divorce a woman, you know, all of that is meant to protect women.
And it's children not meant and the
to
families.
Be an imposition on my individuality. It's supposed to protect women who face a natural difference from men. So when we come back, all right, we talked about that part of abortion. Let's talk about the baby when we come back. Let's talk about that little teeny tiny vulnerable baby. On Catholic Answers Live. What is the Catholic Church? Everybody seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people try to make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carla Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they're our allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The Stigmata, the appearance of Christ's wounds on ordinary believers. Is it real or fake? What's the evidence? And if real, what could God's reason be for causing this? In God's Wounds, author John Clark offers what may be the most thorough, honest, and faithful reckoning with the stigmata ever written, examining the evidence and making sense of it both medically and spiritually. Order God's Wounds today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. If you're just joining us, we're doing a pro-life hour this hour, but we're trying to do so in a slightly different way, to ask pro-choice people on this 53rd anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision, would you be willing to hear the argument one more time and maybe reconsider the pro-choice argument? And under the basic question, if the unborn child is a human being, how should our society, if it's going to be a compassionate society, respond to both the mother and the child and their vulnerabilities? And so we talked a bit about the fact that God has established nature, or if you don't believe in God, at least nature has established that women are made tremendously vulnerable by the bearing and birthing of children in a way that men are not. And our society is just not set up for that vulnerability. Our cold, individualistic society. I don't believe in the warm glow of collectivism. I don't want to, but I do believe in community and love for your neighbor. And our society has become cold look at this is one of the most basic natural. It's probably the most basic natural vulnerability is the vulnerability of the woman who is pregnant, and the response to that in a society that says, "Look, you're on your own," is often abortion. So now let's turn to the child a little bit. And Tom, you've been in this pro-life movement for so long. I do want to say something. I think that there is a fundamental flaw that means the pro-choice movement will eventually shrink and go away as a major force in the world. I don't know if it's going to take 100 years, 500 years, or 1,000 years. But the basic problem is you cannot get around the facts of abortion, and the facts are that a human life is taken in an abortion. And I will go back to Karl-Ernst von Baer and Horatio Storer and the scientists and doctors of the 19th century who discovered this. And look, you go to an embryology textbook and it tells you when the life of a mammal begins. It begins at fertilization. So I think there is and this is why I think sometimes we don't get arguments. We just get, well, you're a man, you shouldn't be talking about this, or other kinds of appeals to anything but reason. Because at root, fundamentally, if you could organize, everybody I think knows, if you could organize a society justly and fairly so that every person is taken care of, you would still end up with this fact that there's a child present there. There's a human being present there. And so the society, people would go, well, it's still not just if we're taking the life of that child. And so, I do think there is a natural human, God put it in us, a tendency towards fairness, and it's unfair for born people to kill unborn people. And I think people know at root that that unfairness exists, and it can't go away because the science can't change. Of course, new insights can come up, but a basic scientific question has been settled. When does the life of a mammal begin? It begins at fertilization, or what we sometimes call conception, although I use fertilization because I think the embryologists are more comfortable with it. So this brings me to a question. You did an interview when you were a young lad, hundreds of years ago, when you were a young lad. You interviewed the president of Planned Parenthood.
Well, not the president, the local head.
The local head of Planned Parenthood.
Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is where the University of Michigan is at.
And I want you to just tell us about that conversation, because it goes back to my point that there's a fatal flaw in the pro-choice argument. And I know this, a lot of pro-choice people just turn the radio off when they hear this, but I'm asking you don't turn it off, because it is a fatal flaw. You're never going to get away from the fact that a human life is taken in abortion. And you're never going to get away from the fact that people don't like unfairness. And so the pro-choice argument is going to lose. I believe that firmly. Like I said, I don't know if it's going to be 1,000 years from now. But just as the pro-slavery argument eventually lost, just as the pro-gladiator argument eventually lost, the pro-choice argument must fail because it's not fair. And people just have a natural, over time, inclination to say, I don't want the world to be unfair. They want it to be just. So tell me about this conversation you had back in when, the 1980s?
Early 1981, January, February. It was wintertime, taking a journalism class at the University of Michigan. And so I went over to interview the head of the Planned Parenthood. It was on North Main Street in Ann Arbor. Her name is Margie Crow. I truly wish her well. I looked online recently and years, and she's still, I don't think she's still working for Planned Parenthood, but just I pray for her and her well-being. This is part of the whole thing of the pro-life, is where you have to love those whom you oppose, realizing that the
you
devil
better.
And his minions are only irreversible enemies.
Right.
But in speaking to her, I quoted from a Planned Parenthood pamphlet from the 60s, which I had read in the book by Dr. Jack and Barbara Wilkie, their pro-life booklet, not their booklet, but it was a book that they had. Anyway, quoted the Planned Parenthood pamphlet, which said, an abortion from 1963, by the way, Cy, 1963.
So this is the Planned Parenthood pamphlet from 1963?
Yep.
Okay, so what did it say?
An abortion requires an operation. It kills the life of a baby after it has begun. It is dangerous to your life and health. So I said that to her, I quoted to her, and she responded and says that, yes, abortion was dangerous to a woman's life and health more so back in 63, but, you know, we've made medical advances since then, so it's no longer dangerous to a woman's life or health otherwise. And I smiled and I responded. I said, okay, but what about that first part, you know, that abortion kills the life of a baby after it's begun? Now, what new information has Planned Parenthood gained to determine that an unborn human person, you know, is not really a baby, is not really a person? And she paused, and then she simply said, this interview is over. And I just said, okay. But that, you talk about the fatal flaw,
yes,
she recognized it. It was like checkmate, and the only way you do is kind of like turn the board over.
Yeah.
And had to short circuit it. And she realized that, and it's like, it's not like, well, we you know, those scientists that Cy was talking about and all these other things, really not the case. We've come to some greater realization. This is ironic, too, because in 65, I remember this being on our, I was only three at the time, but.
You were in college, right?
I was in college.
I remember you were very smart.
I was a prodigy,
yeah. Yeah, three-year-old.
But that Life magazine, which had the Leonard Nielsen's photography about the unborn child. It was one of the best-selling ever. If you recall this one, you can,
yeah,
people can look online, 1965, from Life magazine, which had all these photos of the unborn development of an unborn baby. So that was, you know, 2 years after that pamphlet. So to try to deny, I think you have to go into semantics and say, well, this is really not a person. Well, wait a minute, you guys called it a baby. Now we're going to say, well, yeah, it's human, but it's not a person, therefore it doesn't have rights. But your point is exactly right, Cy. It's a matter of development thereafter. And I said, if you want to look at the difference between a mere cell versus a fertilized human ovum, chronicle them for 9 months in a human
right.
mother's womb and see what happens.
That's Dr. Carl Ernst von Baer's basic insight about development in the womb, which can never be overturned. This is the truth about the, I mean, I can never be overturned. It's just as solid.
It can't
as,
be overcome in as, terms of its logic and truth, basically.
Right, right. So, it was this. He was investigating to see, when does the life of a mammal begin?
Yes.
And I think Carl Ernst von Baer, if it had begun at you know, 20 weeks of pregnancy, he would have said 20 weeks of pregnancy. If it had been, but he chased it all the way back, and he said it's the same organism. What makes it that organism? It's the fertilization of the egg by the sperm. That's the way he spoke about it. So the fertilization of the egg made a new organism. The difference between that organism and Tom Nash is development.
Yes.
It's not different in nature or kind. This, now, I'm not trying to make up science. This is such old science that it's in every embryology textbook. Everybody knows from their high school biology that life begins and then it develops. It's not a question of life is in potential or something. It begins and then it develops. Those are the two things. Now, what is the moral value of the creature at 10 weeks of development or 20 weeks of development? Okay, now we have to do some philosophy and some theology and all of that. But so I don't deny that. I'm just saying scientifically, the biological life of the creature, this is an unovercomable fact that the pro-choice movement must face. You developed from a single cell. I developed. We didn't begin our life at a later point. We developed from that point. So it is a human creature. Now, I remember when by the way, good job on that interview. It's really good to have a good, strong follow-up like that. That was very good.
Yeah, but, I mean, I was ready, and I like a good debate, being an apologist and all, but even back.
But I remember, like, before they overturned Roe v. Wade, like maybe
yeah.
5 or 6 years before,
yeah.
states were trying all kinds of things. You know, they were just, it was all these test cases
yeah, yeah.
to try to, and so one of them was a ban on abortion after 20 weeks.
Yes.
And many people were horrified by this. So I remember someone taking a picture of a developing human fetus at 20 weeks and putting it on Facebook. Mm. And it made people really mad because you know what it looks like? It looks like it looks like a baby. And so I'm not saying looks like is the criterion for is.
No, it can't be.
That's not the, but I am saying like there is a point at which there's no more question. Like I can see someone going, I don't see a human being when they see an embryo. I don't see a human. Okay. Seeing is not the same as knowing.
Precisely.
But the fact is, by 20 weeks, you can both know and see.
Remember the Doritos commercial, Super Bowl 50, where the baby wanted
a Dorito.
Yes. And the mother, they said, oh, look at this. Is fun. And the guy, and then he takes it away, and then the baby's reaching. And obviously, the baby's upset, and that makes mom, speaking of vulnerable positions. But yeah, Narol was calling it an anti-choice ad that humanizes the fetus. It's like, well,
but we're not humanizing the fetus. It's called a human fetus.
Like, yeah.
You can't humanize a human. Like you can dehumanize it.
No.
And I'll give you an example. I know this is brutal and probably too emotional of an appeal. So I did want to be careful not to make, but look, when Columbus came and discovered the Americas.
Yes.
And people have a brown tint to them. And they don't live the way the Europeans live. People thought, these will make pretty good slaves. So they said, they don't reason like we reason. They don't have the same reasoning capacity we have. And the argument was, I don't see any evidence. And these are written arguments. You can go back and read them. These are actually arguments that were in court cases that were made. And the argument was
whether they be Native Americans or imported Africans.
Yeah, but I'm talking about up against Native American people. Yeah. Was they don't reason like we reason. And the arguments had to do with, well, their societies don't look, their dress doesn't look like us, their religion doesn't look like our religion. They're not the same kind of reasoning creature we are. So that meant you didn't need to respect them in the way that you respected European people. And you could, now, eventually, those arguments lost in European courts, but originally, early on, they won, and then they came to be lost. Well, this is analogous. It's not the same. I'm not saying you're making the same argument that enslaved the people of America, but it's an analogous argument. If you say, well, there's qualities missing there that make this recognizable to me as a human being, and as long as those qualities are missing, I won't accept it. And one person might say, well, they don't have our religion, or they don't have our skin color, or they're not as tall as we are, or whatever the argument is. They live closer to nature than we do. So they're not the same kind of creature. Look, the argument that won is the correct argument. The person native to the Americas has all the same rights, and so that you have people like Francisco Vittorio making the argument quite eloquently as a priest and a theologian and a philosopher. They have the right to their own commerce. They have the right to their own society. They have the right to choose whether or not they want to be baptized. All of that stuff that eventually won. It's good that won. You know why? Because that's fair. And those are the same arguments that should win as far as the unborn child goes.
And it's just because any time we've seen in human history the process of dehumanizing someone, whether in Japan they called them the logs, L-O-G-S, and so that was their way you dehumanize some people.
Who got called logs? I don't know.
Some of the people who, within World War II, I'm trying, but you know, and you got the Bataan Death March, but in other words,
they were treating non-Japanese people as less than Japanese, less than human.
And they call them logs, or you know, you talk about in Hitler's Germany or racism in the South that seeing these people, you know, separate but equal. That all this stuff is an attempt that they're not like us. It's dehumanizing them, even though they're out of the womb and grown, like you say. So if we can do it then, are we surprised that it's done earlier? But you're right. You're talking about intrinsic value, intrinsic dignity, and it begins at conception. That is when the human organism, the human person begins. It's
right, and it's the fact that
it's incontrovertible.
And lacking the qualities doesn't make us less human. To do that would be to say, well, a person who's severely disabled is somehow less human because they're lacking
qualities. And that's why we see movements toward euthanasia.
Well, let's talk about the culture of death then, which is a consequence of this Roe versus Wade mentality. This, you know, people like, that's a slippery slope argument. Do you know why people make slippery slope arguments? Because humans keep getting on slippery slopes and sliding down them. So let's talk about that.
It's expedient.
Argument about actually human beings of all kinds are less valued when you treat the unborn as valueless. We'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, featuring Mother Angelica, Teresa Tomeo, and Father Mitch Pacwa. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I want to make the Franciscan argument for life, and not Franciscan St. Francis, but Franciscan Pope Francis, because Pope Francis was an extremely pro-life person who was also kind of popular in the world because he was kind of an eco-friendly pope. He stood up against colonization of peoples, and so his pro-life credentials are in a context of a view of the world and of the human person. And I got to say, I think Pope Francis got his pro-life stuff exactly right. I think right on the money. And because he put abortion in the context, which he, by the way, compared to hiring a hitman. He wasn't always very politic in the way that he talked. But he put abortion as we practice it now in the world, within the context of the consumerist throwaway culture. And the basic argument was that when a society decides that some human lives are inconvenient, costly, or unwanted, it teaches itself to discard people instead of caring for them. So we throw, just like we throw away that paper plate, we begin to have the, we might throw away. Abortion is not just a private choice, according to what Pope Francis taught us. It reflects a culture that solves problems by eliminating the vulnerable, by throwing away things that impinge on our lives. So this throwaway culture that he talked about, a truly humane society, according to Pope Francis, would be measured by how it protects those who are smallest, weakest, and unable to speak for themselves, not by its efficient cutting them out. And so I would just like to talk about Canada for a minute here, Tom. When we talk about the spread of what Pope John Paul came up with was this idea of the culture of death, that when you begin to integrate killing into your society as an accepted part of that society, you're going to lose control of that integration, and there's going to be more and more killing. And he wasn't wrong about that, because now what you have is a culture of death, a culture that Francis would call a throwaway culture, John Paul II would call a culture of death, and that is we solve our problems by means of killing. And what do you think about what you see in Canada as a consequence of, say, Roe versus Wade?
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Could you connect those two things?
Sure. And I think the problem, people, is we talk about radical individualism or autonomy, and yet when we embrace it, we invite the government, because we're basically calling it a good, and the government will step in and promote it as such, and therefore people who are vulnerable are much more likely to be, whether it's the unborn child or the vulnerable person for whatever reason, older in age, to be euthanized, and to be euthanized against their will because they become expendable, they become a burden.
Yeah.
And so you see that in Canada, God bless them, our northern neighbors. Although I do love Canada, they still have God in their national anthem in all sincerity. But here in America, we are moving in that direction because more states are talking about, you know, some assisted suicide laws are in place.
Right. So now we begin to expand death as a solution. Death becomes a solution to illness. Death was a solution to the vulnerability that comes with pregnancy. Now death is a solution to illness.
And if it's a solution, then the government can and should promote it. And of course, then the more vulnerable become even more vulnerable and are more expendable, as you say.
And then you get a society where, I think you remember the famous case of Iceland celebrating the fact that it
no
had
more
cured
Down syndrome.
They cured Down syndrome in Iceland. And the greatest response to that was Patricia Heaton. I don't know Patricia Heaton. I never met Patricia Heaton, but I'm going to love her the rest of my life for her response to that. Because it was
everybody loves Raymond, by the way.
People. Yeah, the mom on not the mom, not the older mom, but the Raymond's wife on
there
Everybody
you go.
Loves Raymond.
There you go.
And I think she loved Raymond, but it was a particular fraught kind of love that she had for Raymond.
Back to Iceland.
But her point was, you didn't cure Down syndrome; you killed all the people who have Down syndrome.
And my little sister had Down syndrome.
And this is why I love her for saying that. She's not just me or you saying that. You know, I'm paid by Catholics who want the pro-life message to get out. She's paid by Hollywood. You know, that's where she makes her living. I think that's gutsy to say something like that.
Yeah, and it was exactly right because that's what they did. And I know that, you know, my little sister, Mary, God rest her soul, they didn't expect her to live days or weeks, let alone months or years, but she had Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Lived 42 years, praise God. Attribute to her tenacity, God's blessing, and my parents' love, family, and everyone. But yes, but isn't it say something about conscience that Iceland felt compelled to say something, like to justify, hey, we've eliminated it.
Yeah.
It's like, as opposed to, we feel like we have to justify it. It's like, you know, getting it's confession without absolution.
Yeah.
The fact that they needed to trumpet that, and it's like, God, take a look. You've done it by killing people, not by curing it.
Well, the thing is, would it be better if we could cure Down syndrome? Yes, it would. Would the world be better without people who have Down syndrome? No, it would not. Like, you have to hold both of those things.
No, it's true, because anybody who's interacted with Down syndrome, children, adults, there's a love, and there's also you don't see this whole thing of keeping a grudge and keeping statistics. There is a detachment from that, and there's a real true love and for people of various situations. You see you see God's joy and his love manifest in the lives of the unborn, Down syndrome children.
But I have to say something that we in the pro-life movement have had to learn from the pro-choice movement.
Yes.
Was pay more attention to the mom.
Yes.
And we are now learning, pay more attention to the family who has a disabled child, or pay more attention to the disabled person. And I want to say to the pro-choice movement, that's good that you pushed us on that. I don't believe in the argument, all you care about is the baby before it's born. Because that's not true. When you get to people in the pro-life movement, these are people who are many times actively caring for, for people well outside the womb, you know. So I never thought that was a good argument, but it's good pressure on us to go, look, because it's easy to forget about the family who has the disabled child who, guess what, their life is really hard and we got to do a better job. And so I feel grateful to the pro-choice movement that it's a pressure movement to look, live, okay, you want to have that pro-life standard? You better live it consistently. And the pro-life people go, you're right, we do have to live it consistently.
And I think part of that consistency is to support them in educational choices while their kids are growing up instead of assigning them. Many presidents would say, oh, we don't send our kids to the D.C. public schools in a tough area near the Capitol or the White House. They would send them to other schools, private schools, which is rather inconsistent, to say the least.
If I can say that, thank you to the pro-choice movement for pushing us on our own values. I want to push you on your own values, and that's what we've tried to do this hour. Next hour, we're going to take some questions, but if your values are about fairness and about the dignity of the human person and about human rights, consider again the pro-life position. It's not an anti-woman position. It may have been espoused as an anti-woman position by some of us in some times, but you pushed us and you taught us, and now will you be open to the pro-life position? Give it a try. I think we can meet each other. I really do. We'll be back in just a minute with more Catholic Answers Live.